I've recently been studying a tidal stream in the Milky Way galaxy. And so tidal streams form when you have a bound object such as a globular cluster being tidally disrupted by the Milky Way into this long, thin, really looks like a stream of stars. And this particular object is turning out to be very interesting and has the potential to tell us something about the dark matter structure on small scales. And so the reason why we are interested, of course, is because our cosmological model makes predictions that there should be just a lot of structure. And this is one way to test them. Of course, we think that this cosmological model is correct because on large scales, the distribution of galaxies in the simulation on the left side and observed on the right side looks almost identical. And so this is from the Bolshoi simulation and the SDSS BOSS survey. And so you can see this pattern of cosmic web, which is such a great validation of the Lambda CDM model, saying that the distribution of galaxies in the observed universe matches the distribution of dark matter halos in a simulation. However, and when we look on the scale of an individual galaxy, the agreement is not so good. So this is when we kind of zoom in on one of those galaxies at the size of the Milky Way, and on the left, we see a dark matter only simulation, and we there's just a lot of structure, those small clumps or subhalos of dark matter. Whereas in the Milky Way galaxy, we do see some satellite galaxies around smaller dwarf galaxies around the Milky Way, and they are shown here in blue, which are the kind of old discoveries, and the red ones, which have happened in the last 10 years or so. But there is just a very great difference in the numbers of substructure we see in the Milky Way halo and that what was predicted in the early simulations. And so this was something almost 20 years ago called the missing satellites problem. So there just seem to be a lot of satellites that we are not discovering. And so in the last 20 years, we have made better simulations. So one of the obvious drawbacks in this picture is that we are seeing light from galaxies, like dwarf galaxies, so those are luminous objects, and comparing them to something that is dark matter only. And so in the most recent iteration of galaxies simulated with both dark matter but also baryonic physics, the prediction looks something like this. So now the number of these objects just drops a lot, and people claim that we have solved the missing satellite problem. So the number of luminous objects that is predicted in simulations is comparable to the number of observed galaxies around the Milky Way. However, this picture still, and when we look into the dark matter, there is still a lot more structure. And so we just said, like, we don't expect this all of those clumps to have stars, so we don't expect them to be observed as satellites, but CDM still predicts there should be there, just only contain dark matter. And so then the question becomes, like, how do we detect them if we can't really just map them or observe them as dwarf galaxies? And Neil here has done some of the most exciting work recently on that front. So of course, as we know that or think dark matter exists because of its gravitational influence on the motions of stars, and we also can kind of try to infer or find these clumps just based on their gravitational influence. And so what? So this is just kind of our motivation. So we really want to kind of search for this low mass subhalos. And anyway, so what Neil was doing is with Ishar Hezaveh, looked into this lens galaxy in ALMA. So this is a picture of a lens galaxy, and it's a Dustian star forming. So there it is observable in the radio bands. And so the grayscale is the optical image, and then this is the lens galaxy in contours. And so to model the lens, what they did was first to subtract this contribution of the mass inferred from the smooth distribution of the galaxy we observe. However, that didn't seem to be quite enough. So when they subtracted this model of a lens, it sounded like that there were some residuals. So they were then they started asking the question: do those residuals get better if we include additional substructure, like a small subhalo of that galaxy? And so this is what is shown on the right here. So the colors are showing the kind of delta likelihood of a model with that is just the galaxy smooth, and the model that is that has a subhalo at the location of the pixel, basically. And so, with red being models that prefer or that are looking better when there is a subhalo. And so, what they find is that they're actually in this part over here. Yeah, it looks like there should be a subhalo, and it is fairly massive. And so this was a really nice way of showing that even if you don't see the light, you can infer the presence of subhalos in galaxies outside of the Milky Way. And this is a really promising approach because it looks like there is on the order of 100 of already known such lenses. So we can, of course, not all of them have been observed with ALMA, but it is kind of the machinery or like the method is already developed. And so we can hope to analyze more of those galaxies and presumably find more of such substructures. And this would kind of get us a sense of the statistics over a large number of galaxies. But if we are really interested in one object in particular to like study it in more detail, we would have to go search for it somewhere closer by. So we're kind of with subhalos discovered galaxies beyond the Milky Way, we can really just kind of count them and look at statistics. But if you want to have additional information on them, studying them in different ways with different probes, we really want something that is more accessible. And so this is what we'll be doing in this talk. So first, in the first part, I'll tell you about tidal streams and why we think they're good tracers of the gravitational potential in general. And then in the second part, we'll focus on this one stream and see if we see any evidence for deviations from this smooth model of the Milky Way, whether and how that fits into this picture of lambda CDM structure on small scales. And so just to get a sense of perspective, here is a map of the night sky as observed by the PanSTARRS survey. So this was a photometric survey operating from Hawaii. And what they did was image 3/4 of the sky in multiple bands, multiple photometric bands, which means that we can measure colors of stars. And so you can see that most of the stars are in this this plane that is in an arc in this projection. But we are really interested in the halo region of the galaxy because that's where we think it would be easier to detect substructure. And so then you immediately perceive the problem that there's not much in the halo. So we need to be kind of a bit smart how we go about studying the halo. And so if you kind of look very hard, you can see that there are some small objects, and those are some of those dwarf galaxies or globular clusters that I mentioned before. And so we would want to try to isolate stars that look like to be members of these objects. And if we kind of focus on one of them, we can see that there may be a way to do it. So what I'm showing over here is the color magnitude diagram of a globular cluster over here, and I think it was M13. And so you can see that in this space of colors on the x-axis and magnitudes on the y-axis, there is the stars are not randomly distributed, so they follow this particular track. And this is coming from the fact that all of the stars in this globular cluster are of the same age. And so the less massive stars, which are still burning hydrogen, live over here. And the more massive stars, which have kind of consumed all of their hydrogen, have started kind of veering up from this track and are on this like slightly offset track towards the red, the so-called red giant branch. And so this is really important because in this space of color and magnitude, stars in globular clusters look different than stars in the Milky Way in general. So if we kind of just select a region in the rest of the galaxy and plot the color magnitude diagram of this window, it looks kind of like a blurred version of the one we have on the left. And that is because there's just multiple populations of stars in the Milky Way of different ages and at different distances. So this kind of gets smeared out. And then if we are really interested in isolating stars that come from globular cluster from those that come from the Milky Way, we can simply do some sort of matched filtering where we preferentially select stars that are more likely to be members of the globular cluster than of the Milky Way. And in practice, what we do is kind of bend the space, then divide and create a 2D histogram, divide those two, and then see in which regions we have the most or the excess of globular cluster stars. And so we can do this at different distances, and then we basically get a map of the stellar halo that looks something like this. So here are different color channels correspond to different distances in the galaxy. And this is just a view of the stellar halo that we saw in the SDSS survey. And so you can see that, again, there's a lot of many of these like small objects that pop out, yeah, many more than we saw before just from the number counts. But then there's also all of these big structures, and this is the most prominent one is the so-called Sagittarius stream, which was first discovered in 94. But then there's also, this is a disrupting dwarf galaxy, which is fairly massive, or one of the more massive dwarf galaxies in the Milky Way. But then there's also a lot of striping that looks more diffuse, such as the stream over here, the one that's kind of shooting upwards. And then over in the corner, we see a globular cluster in the act of being disrupted. So this is the Palomar 5 globular cluster where we see the remnants of the cluster itself and then the tidal tails that they're emanating from the cluster. And so we see all stages of or disruption from different kinds of objects. So both more massive objects like the Sagittarius that produce these white streams, and also the small objects like globular clusters that produce these very thin streams. And we even see objects that no longer have the progenitor. So for example, this stream is called the orphan stream because there is no parent object. And this is the GD1 stream that we'll be talking about a lot later on, which we thought similarly to Palomar 5 is a disruptive globular cluster, but again, has no parent object. So it's just completely disrupted. And so we are mostly interested in this talk, at least, in what the tidal streams can tell us about the distribution of matter in the Milky Way. So in principle, you would initially people were very excited to find these tidal streams because they were telling us that, or directly confirming this picture of hierarchical formation that the cosmological model predicts, because we see the stars becoming part of the Milky Way, but here we'll use them as tracers. And was there a question?
Is that fan thing on the right something, or is it just my
imagination? Like over here?
Yeah,
so that's a very interesting object in its own right. So yeah, this is also not a part of the smooth galaxy. But and there has been a lot of research in the past like 15 years. So initially, you can see it in this figure, but it kind of wraps all around and it's kind of very close to to the stellar disk. So initially, people thought it might have been a satellite that was disrupted on a very kind of orbit aligned with the disk. However, based on the stellar populations, it looks like those stars are too young or too metal rich to actually be a dwarf galaxy such as Sagittarius, because we expect those to be much older. So what it's looking like at the moment is that these are actually stars that have been kicked out of the disk following a passage of a more massive object. And so there are models showing that. Yeah. So it's, really, really interesting object. And yeah, it seems like there's just a lot going on over here. And this is a really important point that, we want to use these structures as tracers, we kind of really want to be sure that they are actually an accreted event and not just some disk perturbation. But like in the halo region that we are focusing on now, it should be fairly safe. And so to use them as tracers, we kind of want to understand how the shape of a stream depends on properties of the galaxy. Yeah.
So this is the match filter you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So this is looking for all the stars.
Yes.
But you still find those things at the right, which are young.
Yeah. It's not a perfect filter. Yeah. Yeah, there's a...
Probably, if you have a different filter for younger stars, you're going to see that as well. Mm-hmm. At the right, is that right?
So this is more of an kind of intermediate age filter. Yeah, so it's not very, very young like some, you know, stars that are currently being formed.
Filter metallicity sensitive as well, or is it just age?
So it's mostly, kind of the location of this turnoff is kind of most sensitive to the age. And then the metallicity effect would be kind of on the tilt of that upper branch. And so with just the photometric data, we don't really have much of a handle. So, you know, there is some degeneracy between age and metallicity. So this is why we don't say, like, I don't quote the age and the metallicity. I just say old and metal poor with kind of a general bucket.
Yeah. We do have a pointer.
I think I saw it. It's a hockey stick. Yes. How appropriate. Okay. And so now moving on to seeing how these objects can serve as tracers. It's really because we understand how satellites disrupt. And so what I'm showing here is one a model of a stream where the progenitor is here at the center. And then like two tidal arms are extending on either side. And so this model has been created by evolving the orbit of this parent object in the galaxy that looks something like this. It has a dark matter halo, a stellar disk, and a stellar bulge. And those kind of, those are the parameters on the mass of the disk, the scale velocity of the halo, and this is the flattening of the, or the shape of the halo. And this is something approximately what we expect the Milky Way to be like. And so when we evolve the orbit of the parent body in this simulation, we can kind of let it lose stars and see where they end up. And then we can repeat this exercise for different values of this for different models of the galaxy. So if we kind of start increasing the halo mass, like it builds in one way. The colors are the radial velocity, so just velocity along the line of sight in the object. And so you can see that as you kind of change the parameters, you change both the velocity structure and the shape of the stream. And so you can kind of imagine that you can back out from what you observed about the stream. You can infer what the parameters of the galaxy would be. And so, people have been doing this, and we recently looked at just how precisely you could measure the properties of the galaxy this way. And so what we were mostly interested in was the total mass of the halo, because because there's been some uncertainty on what it is. And so we performed a fissure information analysis of different Milky Way-like streams in this fiducial model of the galaxy to see with the data currently at hand, what is the expected precision we could have on the halo scale velocity. And so here's the sky view of the different streams. So you can see that they kind of span both hemispheres. So the dashed line is the line of the is the galactic plane. So where all the disks are. And so we see streams are mostly in these halo fields. And so they cover the whole sky and have different lengths. And then they also are color coded by the precision with which we expect we can measure the scale velocity of the halo. And so saturates at 25%, and most of the streams are better than that. So it looks like we should be able to measure the total mass of the galaxy fairly well, and that the different streams are telling us different things about the galaxy. So not all of the streams are equally useful in constraining this particular parameter. And interestingly, even two streams that are kind of in the similar region on the sky can have different predictions on or different constraints on the parameters of the galaxy itself. And we can then, just to kind of get a sense of what different streams bring to the table, we also calculated what is the constraint on the shape of the halo. So this is the parameter that controls the flattening along the x-axis of this dark matter halo. You can see that if I flip between those, there's some streams like this Benzer's 1A, the changes like from something like 10% to, or from something like 20% to something like 10%. And so some streams, even though you might think they're like not very good for one particular parameter, can be very informative in another one. And so, of course, you can kind of sense that the sensible thing to do then would be to really use all of the streams simultaneously. And to motivate this a little bit further, I'm showing here what is the expected precision on those two parameters. So the scale velocity of the dark matter halo and the shape, the z-axis flattening of the dark matter halo, as a function of streams that we include in our analysis. So every dot over here is a combination of streams that we considered. And so we have single streams over here, and then you can see like individual constraints, like the different streams are differently sensitive, and then the median position is over here. And then if we consider pairs of streams, it immediately gets down. And when if you include up to or 11 streams, all of those in our sample, we get a sub percent precision in recovered both the halo velocity and the shape. And so this sounds really great. We see like this is amazing precision. I think the only drawback we would find here is that we don't expect really our model to be to be appropriate on those kinds of scales. So because our calculation here assumed that the halo is just like has one shape, doesn't change with the radius, it's just a triaxial NFW profile. And so this looks exciting that there is information in streams with the current data that can produce such tight constraints, but this is also somewhat driven by this kind of strong prior on the model that we put here. And so to kind of understand what the physical picture here is, we wanted to look at some what streams predict, not just on the parameters of the model directly, such as these two shown on the panels, but also about the physical property of the halo itself. And so, yeah. So
what data is supposed to be used here?
Yeah, so we are assuming that we have, that a stream is observed with something like, So we know the positions just from the discovery paper. We assume that we kind of roughly have some sense of distance at 2 kiloparsec uncertainty, and then Gaia-like proper motion uncertainties and radial velocity uncertainties of a few kilometers a second, which is kind of typical of the number of spectroscopic surveys that are currently operating. So
you don't assume actual distance, because the distance to, you don't have parallax distances from Gaia.
No, most of the streams are actually far away from the sun enough that that Gaia can just say they're not close, basically. So
this is something that we can do at some point, or is there the current data, so it can be done?
Yeah, this is kind of that can be done in principle, but I guess not all of those streams have actually been looked at. So I guess the data is available, but we don't really have the like list of members with a table of those measurements. So I guess it's in principle doable. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So. And then if we, just kind of look at the physical property that these streams constrain, we decided to look into the radial acceleration, which is, again, I guess, think of roughly as a mass enclosed within within that point. And so what I'm showing here is how the constraints on the radial acceleration depend as a function of distance from the galactic center for two of the streams. So the two different lines are just predictions for two different streams. And you can see that, first, they're not equally sensitive. So one is much better than the other because it has, this is on your, like the best measurement here is maybe 80% and here is 5. But then interestingly, both of those features are telling us that not every location in the galaxy is equally well measured by those streams. So there seems to be a location where those streams are most informative. So there is a local minimum to both of these curves. And when we kind of try to understand what's happening here, it turns out that these streams have different normalizations here, mostly because of the stream length. So streams that are long, like more than 40 degrees long, have much tighter constraints on the radial acceleration than streams that are fairly short. And there are a number of streams that are kind of just only a few degrees long. And so that kind of explains the offset between these two curves, that the best acceleration we can measure is really determined by how long the stream is. But then there's the second feature we want to understand, and that is where is this minimum occurring? And so I'll on the right show the location of the best measured radial acceleration on the y-axis as a function of the current position of the stream. And so we can see that in general, streams that are farther away can also measure the acceleration well, like farther out in the halo. But this is not on the one-to-one line, as one might expect would be kind of natural. And so what we wanted to understand is whether this is, again, coming because we are imposing this very rigid structure of what our model of the halo is. And so if we kind of get some aspects of it right, that kind of would propagate farther out. And so, and this is mostly driven by our hypothesis that really streams should be constraining their local properties, so that what streams are actually measuring would be local acceleration within their point. It's just that in this picture, we are not seeing this, and we thought that it might be because our model is not flexible enough to actually reveal that. And so to do that, we included some additional parameters in our model. And so here is when we allow for up to a quadrupole perturbations in this model of our potential. And so we can see that Now the constraints on the acceleration get much worse at all locations for both of the streams. And that is just because we have the same amount of information, but more parameters to fit. But interestingly, it does look like these curves are becoming narrower, so more localized to one specific point in the galaxy. And when we look at this plot on the right, it looks like that the position where the best acceleration is measured is getting closer to the to where the stream is currently in the galaxy. And when we include up to the octopole term, we see that almost all of the streams are now within one sigma from this line. So we it really is looking like what streams are measuring if our model of the galactic potential is sufficiently flexible is actually some local property of the galaxy itself. And this is, I was really excited by this result because we now have found streams at different distances in the galaxy. So this is a picture of streams found in Gaia, both in as kind of moving along the same orbit. So they're detected not only as overdensities like spatially, but also kinematically. So we know that these are kind of streams moving all along the same direction. And so you can, and so as Gaia is a full scale mission, we have both hemispheres covered, and here and the stars are color coded by their by the approximate distance from the sun. And so you can see that there are many of the streams are kind of in this purple region, which is like between 10 and 20 kiloparsecs from us. But there are also some streams like Sagittarius that is farther away beyond 50 kiloparsecs. And so since we're now assuming that that conclusion from before holds, that we have what the streams are actually constraining is local acceleration. This means that we have tracers in different parts of the galaxy that can kind of tell us what just enclosed mass is at that location. And so we can sort of imagine building some non-parametric model of the distribution of matter in the galaxy. And this would be, I think, really interesting to measure the complete radial profile and the shape of the halo. Yeah.
Sorry, that meant the thing with adding quadrupole and octopoles, what is the radial dependence testing quadrupole and octopole?
So, I'm playing the power law.
It's a power law.
Yeah.
So the monopole that was an NFW, and you're adding a power law with an arbitrary power with octopole.
We are fixing the power, right?
We want
minus two.
Minus two?
Yeah. Thanks. Okay, and so and kind of tied back to the story of what can we learn about dark matter, I think there are many predictions of what shapes of the halos on the Milky Way scale would be in different models, depending on the nature of dark matter particle. But, and this is kind of just what we can learn from these general properties of streams that, that if we observe them like this, unperturbed, and just measure their kind of global shape or global velocity trends along the stream. But really what we expect the streams to look like if our model of CDM is correct is something more disturbed. So here I'm showing a comparison of a stream that has been formed in a cosmological halo. So it's from the Via Láctea 2 simulation, which has a lot of subhalos that can perturb this simple structure that a stream in analytic potential that would look like this in this cosmological halo, it would have interacted with subhalos, and so they would disperse stars beyond the stream, cause this different density variations along the stream, and even produce larger gaps such as this one over here. And so this is like a kind of, we are now moving into the second part of the talk where we really are interested in this more small scale structure of the halo, and which can be teased out from this substructure seen in the stream itself. And this is, you know, people have tried to do this before, but it has been very challenging because the seller streams are a very small part of the total seller population. So actually isolating them from the contamination or, you know, other stars in the Milky Way, which are contamination in our case, is very hard. And so here is a view of this GD1 stream in SUSS survey. And we just basically the best view of the stream we had until Gaia came. And so you can clearly see that there is an overdensity and it looks kind of like a stream. And then you might even say, there look like there's, you know, maybe there is a gap over here, but it is just very noisy because we like to create this map. We, in every pixel, we have to kind of do that match filter exercise. And so we couldn't, there are just like not enough stars to see them individually. So it is kind of average. And then there's also just variations in the Milky Way population. So you can see, like, if you take one slide over here, there are density variations that are kind of comparable to what we might call a gap over here. So it has been kind of hard to attribute any of the structures that we saw in the early data to something, you know, related to the dark matter rather than just being an observational effect. But this all changed, and I just realized that it is exactly 4 months ago, on April 25th, the Gaia team, so this released their second batch of data. And so Gaia is a space mission from a European space mission, and they just continually scan the sky and measure a lot of properties of everything they detect as point sources. So in this case, we'll be mainly interested in stars. And so here is the view of the sky with Gaia. And so what changed from what we had before, when we were only relying on colors of stars to isolate members of a stellar stream, is that now we have velocities. And so with Gaia data, what we can do now is just kind of play the movie. And so these are just nearby stars, but you will see like some groups that are moving over here together. And you can kind of imagine then, if you're interested in some specific group of stars that is moving in a particular direction, you can now have this additional constraint to remove everything else that is not moving in that direction. Like the movie like this can only be, so with 3D velocities from Gaia can be only created for something like 7 million stars that are very close to the sun. But for 2 billion stars, we have two components of the proper motion. So the velocity in the plane of the sky. And that helps a lot. another thing that Gaia did here is also measure distances again to the stars via parallax. And even though those distances the objects that are in the halo that we are interested in studying don't have a good distance estimate, we can at least remove everything else that is nearby that we are not interested in. And so in this, on the first day after when the data was released, I was actually with Dustin in New York at the CCA and working with Adrian Price-Whelan, where we decided to look into the GD1 stream. So GD1 is that long stream, and we, from our previous studies, we expected the long streams to be informative. So that's why we wanted to see what it appears like in Gaia. And so we first just selected the stars that are far away in that region of the sky and got this map that looks, you know, very smooth, but still, even with that cut, we don't see the stream. However, if we look into the proper motion space, so here is I'm showing the proper motion in two directions on the sky, we can clearly see three clumps. And then it turns out that these two are the disk stars and the halo stars in that field. And then there is like this outlier close to mu phi 1, or the proper motion in this phi 2 direction that is close to zero, which turns out as actually in the GD1 stars. So if we select them, we immediately see the stream pop out. And this is just in star counts. So there's no binning here. So we can immediately see the improvement over what we had before. But we wanted to do better because we still have the color information for all of those stars. So if we plot the color magnitude diagram of that region, you can again see there this shape that I saw before of the track in the color magnitude space that we expect from an old and metal poor population. So if we additionally select on depth two, we get this really clean map of the of GD1. And so, of course, you know, it's not perfect. There are some, there is still some contamination left, but really at a much, much lower level than we had before. And so just looking at this figure, which is really all we did in this first paper, we can immediately see many things. They're qualitatively different from what we knew about this stream before. And so first of them is we extended the stream for something like 20 degrees because now that we can look at this very low surface brightness parts of the stream, we can see that it extends much farther away than we initially thought. But then most interestingly, from the perspective of learning about the halo, we saw these two gaps, which now appear, yeah, very, very high significance. And you can kind of see that they look different from each other too. So this one almost looked like it's completely empty. So the level of, or the number of stars in the gap is similar to the number of stars kind of above and below. And this one, it looks like it still has at least some stars remaining. And so what we thought might cause something like this is that actually the progenitor we don't see is because it actually fully disrupted over here. And then these are just kind of two star sides of the stream that are kind of moving far, like moving away from each other. But then a really unexpected thing is from this map is that we also seem to see stars that are kind of offside of the stream. So there's the clear GD1 track. But then there's like a small overdensity of stars over here, which we call the spur, and there's the small overdensity over here that we called the blob. And this is something that was not expected for streams such as thin as GD1 is.
They're just like random distributions. I don't know how you identify it. My eye looks like they're everywhere. There are spurs and blobs and stuff.
Yeah, I guess it might be that we have something we call the astronomer goggles. So it does. This looks, you know, like a high sigma detection. I can.
Brands, I guess.
Yeah, so I can sketch you. So we did the experiment actually just to quantify this. So if we have the stream over here and then allow to kind of, if we bin it along this direction and then we fit for a, you know, for the stream and the background or like we kind of chunk up this space, plot the distribution of, I guess this is number of along that phi two. And so we fit the distribution in different parts of the stream all along the, so with a Gaussian on the stream track and then allowed for like a Gaussian here and a Gaussian here and plus some background. And then we actually can show that in the region of the spur, there is like the amplitude of this is like different than zero at three sigma. Yeah.
Where is that local three sigma?
Yeah, it's local. Sorry?
The look elsewhere effect. You know, you knew where to look, right? But you could have had blobs everywhere else.
Yeah. So
did you make some kind of...
Okay, so let me see. What's the... Maybe... Okay, let's hold on to that because I don't want to give away like a nice slide. But yeah, we did basically this exercise like all along the stream, and the only location where like this is non-zero is where we indicated over there. And I will say the blob is, it could be consistent with, you know, just a background thing. But the spur really does seem to be like a separate, so it's a stronger detection.
Can I ask, so yeah. I guess if it's, normally you expect the leading stream and the trailing stream to have the same number of stars, roughly speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true relative to that progenitor, the marked progenitor?
Yeah. We actually haven't counted them. Just on the sky, they don't extend the same amount. So they're this site is shorter, and we tried looking beyond. It gets harder because it is getting into this region of the galactic disk, and also there is a proper motion gradient. So like stars moving here are moving more similar to the disk star, so it's harder to isolate them with Gaia. But we didn't really see it extending much past that. So it's still an open question, yeah, exactly why that is, why it's so asymmetrical. There are like a number of facts why the people have looked into those arms being not the same, but I'm not sure that they would be valid here. So yeah, it's an open question. And yeah, this is kind of a good segue into this slide. So since we have the gap proper motions and radial velocities from before, we could find an orbit for the stream. And so on the left, I'm showing the last 5 kilometers of the orbit, and then the bullet part is where the stream is now. And so kind of zooming in on that region, we can create a model of the stream such that the progenitor destructs over here, and then you can see that stream is slightly misaligned from the orbit, and in general, it kind of follows the track of the GD1 that we have observed, but it doesn't have this second gap or any stars kind of off of the stream. So in the simple, smooth model of the galaxy, we can, you know, create this one gap just by requiring that the progenitor disrupted there, but none of the other structures. And kind of just to go back to your question, yeah, we do see them, like those arms are like very symmetrical and extending further on. So we wanted to kind of understand, yeah, clearly we need something more in addition to this simple model of the Milky Way to explain that. And there's been a lot of work on what in effect of a subhalo passing by a stream would look like. And so this is... So on the left, there's several snapshots of different times after the impact of the encounter between a cold, thin stellar stream and a dark matter subhalo, and you can see that like depending on different viewing angles and different kind of configurations of the impact, you can get all of these weird like either gaps and these kind of folds that where you can kind of imagine seeing that as the spur that we saw before and all sorts of these different morphologies. But what kind of the community settled on is really just study properties of gaps in streams. And it is, I think, probably because that's kind of what we knew, we hoped that we could get eventually too. And so this is just showing how streams on the same orbit would look like if the encounter was moving at different velocities, or how close to the stream it came, and then how massive it was. And there's just a huge body of literature on saying if you measure different properties of the gap, like the density profile along the stream, what can you learn about the properties of the impact? But really, not much work has been done on what can you learn if you actually see stream in this phase over here, where you not only have a gap, but you also have stars that are kind of parallel to the stream. And so this is what I've been working on for the past 3 months or so. And we started with a simple kind of experiment, starting from a line of stars that is not moving and it's in free space. and see how that gets distorted if a massive object passes by. So here we have them aligned along the y equals zero direction, and the and our massive perturber, which is in this case a point mass, passes like perpendicular, like along the z-axis, and then see that it's gives a velocity kick to all of the stars. They start moving to where the perturber passed, and then slowly form these loops. And so in this model, we can kind of naturally predict that the stream no longer is this one-dimensional object, but it does have kind of stars outside of the main track of the stream. And then the hope was that if you observe it at you know, some a different configuration, that we might see something like what we saw in GD1. And there are, you know, some streams that look like loops, but then some they look like there might be something you call a spur or so. But what this model actually missed was the gap that we also see. We thought that this is probably due to our using only studying the stars in the free space. So our next kind of step in creating a more realistic model was to actually perturb a stream or a line of stars that is moving in something like a Milky Way galaxy. So we'll start here with stars on initially a circular orbit, orbiting in a logarithmic halo, which is our approximation in this study for the Milky Way potential, because it just has a flat rotation curve. So, and yeah, it's simple. And so what happens then, we'll show in dark blue that the loop again forms, but it also is kind of moving around and getting extended around the stream, so that it not only has stars that are beyond the main stream track, which would have been like in light blue had the stream remained unperturbed, but there also seems like there is a lower density of stars in this region, so it does seem to produce a gap as well. And so if we kind of, when I saw this, I was immediately excited, because also is if I replay this again, it looks like at certain times that one side of the loop is kind of behind the stream like here, and only one side is kind of sticking out like the spur that we see. And so if we kind of observe the stream in this moment, on the sky and compare it to GD1, this is what we get. So it does look like there is a gap, and there is this spur over here, and there is just a lower density of stars right here. And now I will, sorry, get back to your question about how significant the spur is. So we have this visualization where this is the GD1 stars color-coded by the probability of being a member. And the membership probability was defined like with this case. So we solved for like, or we allowed for two Gaussians on either side of the stream. And you can see that only in this region of the spur, there are stars that are kind of allowed, and only in this region of the blob, there are stars allowed kind of to above the background levels. So we do think those are actually real structures.
But how do you decide, how far the Gaussians are from the main stream?
Oh, that's also allowed to be a free parameter.
So
we solve for, yeah. You just record there like on either side. Yeah.
So again, with my astronomer eyes on, this mm-hmm. right-hand side looks way colder, like thinner than on.
Indeed. Yeah, so that is, so we see that also in the model. I think I have it. I think we can look at it over here. So this is our, like now, a model that we adopted as fiducial. So we have the observed stream on the top, and on the bottom, we now kind of did away with this toy model of the stream just on a circular orbit. We put stars, like model of the GD1 stream on the orbit of the GD1 stream, and then perturbed it and these are the parameters of the impact. And so you can see that like one of the gaps, so we recorded that the pretender disrupted here, and you see that this part, even in the smooth model, is wider over here. And so I think at least partly that is due because that part of the stream is actually closer. There is a strong distance gradient along the stream, but I don't know, like we haven't really quantified that in any detail. And again, to go back to that question, our model happily continues beyond the where we don't see the stream anymore. So it's not a perfect model, but I think it does kind of capture a lot of what we see in the GD1, especially in this region of the spur, because we have both the loop that get, kind of what we've been calling the loop, the stars that are initially here are not kind of extended all the way out here as part of the spur and are kind of puffy in the gap as we see in the observed part. And so we somewhat tweaked the range in which we were searching for this model. So it is in a kind of a viable model as in cosmologically interesting mass regime, and it has some reasonable halo velocity. It is very compact. this is 10 times more compact than what we would expect for the cold dark matter. And so we also wanted to...
Sorry, what is RS?
So this is a scale radius of the perturber.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so to just kind of get a handle on what is the allowed parameter space, we had a pseudo likelihood in which we try to match the observed location of the spur and the position and the width of the gap. And so here are the posterior distribution of the parameters of our model. So it does seem to be a fairly recent interaction. So the time is something around half a giga year. It seems really to have come very close to the stream, the perturber. There is some preference for high velocities, which I don't really understand, but there is also the velocity mass degeneracy, which we do expect. But then, yeah, curiously, this is the distribution of sizes, basically, of the perturber, and they are very compact. And then finally, in the mass, it looks like it's something around 10 to the 7 solar masses. And just for comparison, our
velocity. Like,
sorry.
What's going on with the velocity? Like it just keeps
going. Yeah, I don't. So there is the almost the exact mass velocity degeneracy. So you can get the same impulse to the stream if you are more massive or moving more slowly, because you have kind of longer time to interact. So that explains, this degeneracy. I don't know why this is being preferred. And we put a prior cutoff at 500 kilometers a second here, just because, yeah, we thought that it's kind of reasonable range of objects in the halo to be moving at. I will stress again that this is, just a pseudo likelihood. We don't have a full generative model, so it may be that some deficiency in that comparison is kind of driving that effect. Yep. Yeah.
So am I right that so this dwarf would have made a few orbits around the Milky Way?
You mean the subhalo?
Yeah, the subhalo.
Yeah, I would guess so. But
I'm just wondering. So it is the picture that its own dark matter halo already got stripped off in the past, negligible, or in other words, does its own dark matter halo play any role in the?
Yeah, that's the, well, I guess we try to be agnostic up to this point on what the actual perturber is. So we just solve for the parameters, and now I will just show what it couldn't have been, and then leave with some questions with what it could have been. This is all of the constraints we have is like on the mass and the kind of the size. And we do know
about like the GD1 dark matter,
numbers about.
I was wondering about the hit, the dwarf that's being stripped. It originally had
a cluster. What?
Oh, okay.
A cluster.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Thanks for catching that. okay. Yeah. So then we were like, okay, could a known object have caused this? And so in this plot, I'm showing the relative distance between the known satellites of the Milky Way, and in different, they're just color basically by mass. So the classical dwarfs are the most massive, and the ultrafaints are less massive, and the globular clusters are objects without dark matter, as Neil was saying, and then the lightest color is just the stellar disk. And so we see that none of the halo objects comes remotely close to GD1 to actually to interact in that way. So yeah, we cut off here at 100 parsecs, and our impact parameters were on the order of 10 or so, or the impact parameters we infer needed to have happened. And so then people have suggested that maybe clumpy objects in the stellar disk, like the giant molecular clouds, could have caused it. But then in this case, we know the orbit at which on which GD1 is, and we know that molecular clouds in the stellar disk should be on a circular orbit. So we have we have constrained the geometry of this impact. And so if we kind of, and the only really free parameter is like on which side of the, or what's kind of the spatial angle between the GD1 when it's crossing the disk and the molecular cloud. And so we looked into the possible scenarios at the first or like the most recent crossing of the disk. And these are the different colors are just different models, and none really look like the structure we see in GD1. And similar for the second disk crossing. So you see that, you know, you can form a gap and a spur, but it's in a wrong location. So I think we can rule out that it was a molecular cloud or any disk passage that caused this feature in GD1. And so this kind of leaves us, yeah, with an unknown massive object and also very dense, so it could be really great to try and find it. For that, we would really need more data. So I'm showing here three different draws from our posterior distribution, and on the left side is the distribution of stars, and so you can see that it formed a gap and it formed a spur, and like this other side of the loop is kind of behind the stream. And then I'm showing the difference in radial velocity in the same region of the stream, and you can see that for the different kind of impact parameter, or like the different way the subhalo or perturber was moving, you get different velocity signatures. And so at the moment, just with the photometric data, we can't really constrain the orbit of the perturber, but with additional kinematics, we might hope to do that. And then I think kind of to go back to our initial motivation for finding substructure in the Milky Way was that we can follow it up with different ways, not just with this one kind of look at it, find evidence of it of dark substructure, but actually just with streams, but see if we can do it in any other way. And so there's just like, after actually talking to other people here, some possible ways that we want to suggest if kind of down the line, we imagine that we do get the radial velocities and have some constraint on the orbit of the perturber, then we might say, since we know the time of the impact, so say like, oh, it should be there. And we can just go and check in Fermi whether we see any signatures of annihilation. Or if we know the orbit, we know when it should have passed through the disk. Or if it passed through the disk of the Milky Way, we can look for disturbances in the disks. So there's been recent news of there's like this kind of spiral pattern locally in the solar neighborhood that seems to have originated from such a disturbance by a much more massive object. And then there's even more tentative suggestions that the presence of a massive object in the halo would also change how stars move. And so here is one effect that was discussed in this Van Tilburg paper recently, that there should be you know, an excess of kind of co-moving stars towards close to the subhalo versus just like in general parts, they would be just moving more randomly. And so this is, I think, all for the future and really something that we would kind of need to actually confirm the presence of a dark subhalo in the galaxy. But for now, I'll just end with saying that with the tidal streams, we can learn about the just general distribution of matter in the galaxy from their global shape. And then this one object, the GD1 stream that we see that has a gap and the stars off the stream, that there is a model in which a massive dense encounter created this. And so I think it's, yeah, we actually now have a target for searches for dark matter substructure in the Milky Way halo. Thanks.
So I guess one thing you didn't mention is the rate of stripping the progenitor, because of course the reason you do have a stream is you're stripping something from the progenitor. Yeah. Mm. Because that doesn't have to be a uniform rate.
Yeah.
It's only if you get higher tidal region, you would strip more, and then lower tidal would strip less. So could the features you see be actually kind of fossils of the stripping history rather than what happened afterwards?
Yeah, I think it's unlikely. So it would have to, I think, not only would it need to have been like very episodic stripping, which we don't think is happening here.
Discover the Milky Way, for example, that does.
No, yeah, that's not enough now to do that kind of thing, right. Yeah. Because it really needs to be a very kind of localized perturbation, like a giant molecular cloud, like a more dense than just the smooth, the distribution of the disk. And one additional reason that this stream is kind of more robust to such perturbances is that it is moving on a retrograde orbit from the Milky Way stars.
Perturbances of the stream. I'm talking about creating the stream. So it comes from either disturbing a progenitor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if the tidal field is low, then you won't generate a stream because everything is tidally bound to the object. So basically, I guess the way you form a string and your progenitor moves through a tidal field, and if the tides become stronger, then things that were bound become unbound, and then they move away from basically. Then they move on the stream. So by then, that should depend on the tidal history of the progenitor, shouldn't it? I guess that's something at least needs to be simulated.
Yeah, so basically, you know, this model that we showed over here, so this is actually a model of the stream progenitor that is losing stars in a realistic way and passing through the disk, and you just don't see that kind of an effect. Yeah.
So that's saying you just have a disk there and and when you go through it, nothing special happens.
So that's what I meant. You would need something in addition to just the regular disk to actually create that, or you would need to have like some, you know, very contrived velocity structure in the progenitor that at some point it just kind of shoots stars with slightly different energies. Yeah.
So if there's, like with this impact, would you expect like some stars to really to be given? Is there any chance that there were stars that scattered outside of your little selection box?
Oh.
Like that might have a consistent motion and history with coming from?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, so I guess, yeah, we could look into those. I'm guessing the stars that are closest to the location of the impact are the ones who received the largest kick. So, yeah, I think, I guess a blind search, I think, might be kind of hard. But I think if we have, like, everything else pinned down and know, like, for the most of the kind of the bulk of the bulk of these stars, how they are moving, then I think we will be able to predict if there are like some high velocity stars that are, you know, should be traced like exactly here. So yeah, I think that would be a pretty cool prediction to make. And
I think it's the same question as my answer. I remember going to a talk on streams, and the speaker in answer to a question said, well, of course, the streams also form gaps naturally, but I don't know what the mechanism, I don't remember what the mechanism for that is. So in other words, you don't necessarily need a perturber.
Yeah, so I don't have a very good visualization of that, but, you know, it can kind of... We can see hints. So this is the model of the stream. And so you can see it's not really like a line. It looks like there are like these wiggles. And that happens because what the stars are actually doing, you can kind of imagine that this is the orbit, the progenitor, and what the stream stars are doing is kind of epicycling around it.
Some internal.
Because they're like when the stars are released from the stream, they're not released from on the same orbit, but from the Lagrange points that are on orbits that have slightly different energy. And so that's why they're kind of epicycling around. So if I had plotted this as transparent, you would see like there'd be pileups over here. And so you do expect this kind of very regular pattern of density variations along the stream just to come from the way it was disrupted, but nothing as dramatic as we saw. And it would, you know, it should be regular and not just one off. Yeah.
See that? You measure that?
Not in the GD1 stream. So also this, this is, I think most
of like the stream or something.
Yeah.
Periodicity.
Yeah, because with a much better, I guess, completeness, like sense of how complete the data is along the stream. Yeah, you would want to do that. And it's like in GD1, it's I think those are kind of fairly stretched out, so not as visible, but they have been detected close to polymer 5. Probably not on the not in this map.
Any periods.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so 100%. Yeah, anyway, so like in this stream where we know where the progenitor is, the globular cluster. So not in this map, but when you kind of zoom in and have just a more targeted search just around it, you can see that there are two kind of these overdensities on either side of the globular cluster. So that's why this particular object has been kind of harder to interpret as showing any evidence of dark matter substructure because, it's contaminated with this. But the, Okay, thank you.